This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio with guest host Jane Brown.
Libby is back tomorrow for Free for All Friday. Glad you could join me today. And it is a busy week at Toronto City Hall as Mayor Olivia Chow and city councillors react to what was in and not in the federal Liberal budget delivered on Tuesday. And the mayor and councillors today and yesterday have also been taking care of city business, which includes the debacle around the rollout of the vacant home tax and how to improve the system.
And now it's time to tune into the town.
Our municipal tune into the town panel is Alex Blumenstein, co-founder of The Peak, Karen Stintz, CEO of Variety Village, and David Crombie, former mayor of Toronto, among many other accomplishments. Hello to you all.
Hello.
Hi, Jane.
Alex is in studio with me, and Karen and David are remote. Well, we know the mayor is happy about the budget's emphasis on creating affordable housing, 3.9 million new homes by 2031. Olivia Chow told reporters after Chrystia Freeland brought down the budget, we can start building housing and some percentage of it will be affordable. Let's start there, Alex, with how what's been announced by the feds will help solve our housing crisis.
Sure. I mean, they've taken a number of measures that will alleviate some of the housing crunch here. More funding. I think it's not exactly clear how much of the several billion dollars is going to be going to Toronto specifically out of like the bigger housing fund, which is 15 something billion. They've also freed up some land, the federal land that can have housing built on it. So I think that's a really positive step. I would just, this is almost personal because I happened to tune into a Committee of Adjustments hearing at City Hall yesterday. And ultimately, though, it comes down to the city if they really want to solve this housing crisis, because you hear this refrain over and over again where you have these projects that want to add density to the city. And these people on the Committee of Adjustments say, this is a great project. It's fantastic that we're adding density. It's the right project, but not the right place. So I think that the city needs to step up and make some changes to their own zoning rules and allow density as a right, which will allow federal money to go into projects quicker and get things built faster and add density throughout the city.
Karen, coming at it from a former city councillor's point of view, and now you are going to be running for the Conservatives federally, how does this all work? I mean, it sounds like tons and tons of housing, but how does it work from Toronto's perspective?
Yeah, you know, unfortunately, the building time from, you know, from concept to when you put the key in the lock of a new home is a long time. And, you know, we've got some in Toronto, we've got some of the longest approval times in North America. And so part of what we need to do is figure out how to get approvals done and projects under construction and people moved in at a much more rapid pace than we currently see. And, you know, some of the projects around, you know, forcing density in neighborhoods, you can do that. Some of those projects are economically viable, some are not. And so I think that we end up not having the right discussions if we focus on how some neighborhoods are responding to density. The conversation we need to have is how do we get these projects approved quicker, and particularly when there's federal money involved and along transit lines. And that's what Pierre Poilievre has been talking about, is that it doesn't make any sense that our housing prices are as expensive as they are, except for the fact that we don't have enough. And making sure we have more means we have to shorten that approval cycle and actually get shovels in the ground.
David, your initial thoughts on the federal money for housing in Toronto?
Well, I think the federal government is moving in the right direction. I don't think anybody says that they are not. Well, some people it might be, but they are. But the important thing is to try and get the thing going as soon as possible. There are lots of things that can be done that aren't being done, and that is finding, making sure that we've got land to be able to build on that is public land that is able to accept affordable housing. It's fine for someone to say the problem is supply.
Okay, David, sorry to interrupt. We have a problem with your line, David, so I'm going to let Ziv take care of that and go back to Alex here in studio. Just this morning, Alex, reports from both the CMHC and RBC saying we need construction workers in Canada to build these homes, mm-hmm. and that we could be looking at a shortfall of 500,000 construction workers. So it's great to dedicate the money and the time and all of that, but do we have the people to build the homes?
Yeah, that's obviously a massive problem. Money's one step. Allowances, zoning is another step, and then there's the operations of it, right? And clearly something needs to change if there's this massive labor deficit. It seems like we're likely bringing people in who are not filling the jobs that we need people to fill, and probably there's, you know, the longer term planning of having people who are going to school, just both high schools and post-secondaries, to put them into the construction field. If all this money is going to be going into building, then it should be a great field to get into, and that should be encouraged for people who have already come here and or born here, as well as bringing, you know, new people in. It's a great industry, and we should encourage that.
Construction workers and nurses.
Yeah, both.
That's what we need.
Absolutely.
Karen, I want to pick up on what you were saying as well. And it's very likely that we are going to have a change of government, if not in the next year, then in the next year and a half. And should the Conservatives win and Pierre Poilievre become Prime Minister and you become a Member of Parliament for the Conservatives, how does what's been promised by the Liberals transition to the Conservative government and commitment to keep the ball rolling in Toronto with housing?
Well, the federal government, or Pierre Poilievre, has been very consistent that he's going to fund outcomes. He's not going to make announcements that don't lead to outcomes. And so any funding that carries over has to have clear commitments to units being built, homes being produced, and, you know, people being able to afford them. And so unless those commitments are clear, then that'll be a harder sell. But the reality is there is an awareness across all parties that we don't have affordable housing. We don't have, the next generation is looking at limited options for home ownership and even now getting priced out of the rental market. And so that is something that is, very much in the national interest and needs to be addressed.
We all know how serious the homelessness situation is in Toronto and the encampment situation. And over the last year, we experienced what it was like having refugees arrive in this country, in the city of Toronto, without any support from the feds. But now that does seem to be happening and was mentioned, Alex, in this budget. And that is certainly a relief to the administration at City Hall.
Absolutely. I mean, I think there was obviously a bit of a tiff over this earlier in the year where refugees are a federal responsibility, but they seem to not want to fund that and take responsibility for this. So they came to an agreement and started funding it, and they have and they said in the budget that they will continue to fund this, which is, very necessary as we continue to have refugees come here and we have settlement services that we need to pay for, along with just our, existing housing issues. So it's definitely encouraging to see that these problems, will persist in many ways, especially, and homelessness in itself, I think building housing is extremely important for that. That shouldn't be overlooked, but there's all sorts of other issues that impact it and won't be solved overnight. But it's definitely on the right track.
So specifically on the refugees, mm-hmm. the budget includes $1.1 billion over 3 years to extend a housing assistance program for asylum claimants and $743+ million over 5 years to strengthen the asylum system and streamline the claims and removal processes. Karen, again, from your City Hall perspective, how does that sound?
Yeah, it's a complicated issue, right? Because, you can process asylum seekers, but once they're in the system, it's very difficult to, you're not going to send anybody home. And so it really is about putting them on a path to, you know, some type of permanent residency or citizenship. And that looks very different. And so figuring out how to make that transition is key, as well as managing the immigration that's coming through the multiple streams that we have right now. And so trying to rationalize that, as you know, that's the city doesn't have any control over any of that. It just has to deal with it on the ground. And so that's the hardest part the city's grappling with, is that there are international students coming in, there are foreign workers coming in, there are asylum seekers coming in, there are immigrants coming in through the immigration stream, and the city is trying to manage all of it without any ability to input or control any of it.
Mm-hmm. We are with our tune into the town municipal panel. Zeev is trying to get David Crombie back with us. That's Karen Stint, CEO of Variety Village, a former city councillor and now a candidate for the Conservatives in the next federal election. And with me here in studio, Alex Blumenstein, co-founder of The Peak. I wonder, Alex, what you think about all of the cultural money for Toronto that was announced in this budget for TIFF, for the Harbourfront Centre, for the ROM. That is an indication, usually when culture is funded, that means times are good, which, you know, could be ironic at this moment.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it means times are good or there's an election coming up. So I think it's that there's an election coming up. I'm certainly generally in favor of funding these types of things. And I mean, I think if we look at, you know, the Harbourfront Center, you need to put money into keeping, you know, physical infrastructure in place, right? Like, that's super important. Something like TIFF, obviously there is a economic impact to our city. It could probably be more self-sustaining if they clawed back a little bit of the funding. It is such an international event that they should be able to make it, you know, profitable just off of sponsorship and all of that. It's such a great thing for our city. And because it's such a great thing for our city, people should pay to be attached to it. And obviously that happens already. The ROM, again, a great sort of institution in our city, needs funding. They're taking on this big capital project already that, in my opinion, is probably a little bit unnecessary. Just because I'm an advocate for the Crystal, I've always been an advocate for the Crystal before construction, after construction, and now they're trying to open up the entrance a little bit more, which I understand. But I like it, and
yeah,
and obviously they started this capital project prior to this announcement, but. You know, I'd save some money by just not doing that construction, in my opinion.
And I just want to remind you all out there listening that our lines are always open if you would like in on the conversation. Your thoughts as a Torontonian or as a GTA resident on what you heard for our area of the country in the federal budget, 416-360-0740, 1-866-744-740. I believe we have David Crombie on a better line now. David, sorry, I had to interrupt you there before, and I'll catch you up here in just a moment, but maybe you can finish your thoughts on your initial feelings on this budget related to Toronto.
No, thank you. And I apologize to you and the others. I don't know what happened. At any rate, I was trying to make the point that whatever needs to be done for market housing, and I heard Karen speak to that, if you're going to have affordable housing in the city, it requires more than simply understanding that supply will do it. It needs to have really well done government participation with the private sector and community groups to build housing. It's not simply a simple question of supply. And the more we keep repeating that and don't insist that we find ways in which to work governments and community groups and the private sector who are builders together, we're not going to have affordable housing.
And so what do you think in terms of what was offered in actually making it happen in relation to what you're talking about there?
No, I think that the federal government, for those who are interested in building affordable housing, that I think it's lining up the things that are required in order to do it. What it needs to do and what needs to be done is whether it's take the leadership from the city, which I prefer, or from the federal government or the provincial government, some government has to take the lead and say, here's projects. Here's a set of projects that comes from land ownership that either has been public or we've gathered it together in terms of land banking. We have to find ways to work on actual public projects. and not simply assume that if you make an announcement, it is done.
Mm-hmm. And while we were getting you back, we talked about as well, David, what would happen if in the next year, year and a half at the latest, we have a new government, a conservative government in Ottawa. What happens with all of these promises?
Oh, well, as governments change, things will change for sure. And I'm not sure where a conservative government would take us, but there's no doubt that if you opt to change the government, you're going to get changed policies, particularly if there's a hard-edged view on certain kinds of changes, for sure.
Okay. Now, this was sort of buried. I mean, it's a 400-page document, the federal budget, and Chrystia Freeland delivered it in about 40 minutes. So obviously not everything gets mentioned. Far from everything gets mentioned. But there is a new momentum around a high-speed train between Toronto and Quebec City. And Karen, as you know, we've been talking about this for decades. What are your thoughts on it actually happening?
You know, it's one of those things, if it actually happens, fantastic. If you ask me if I think that's the highest priority, I'm going to probably suggest no. You know, high-speed transit and high-speed trains are, you know, can be very beneficial and economical and can support, again, the movement of people through jurisdictions. And so that part is all good. But we have a number of pressing needs. And, you know, I would say that the TTC's needs are quite pressing. And managing the existing line and rail and the new cars that are needed, they are needed. And that's a today issue. And so, you know, in terms of priority, I'm surprised that the high-speed train from Toronto to Quebec City would get prioritized over the needs of the TTC.
What about you, Alex? Surprised by that?
I agree with Karen that the TTC is much more in need and is much more of a pressing issue. But our intra-city trains, our via rail, is truly an embarrassment. I think that all sorts of other countries, even America, has better trains than we have, and they have a massive infrastructure deficit. Obviously, you look at Europe, you look at Asia, they're just miles and miles ahead. The biggest issue I have, we don't need high speed, we at least need high frequency or regular frequency, reliable frequency. The biggest mistake we ever did as a country when it comes to trains was giving priority, privatizing it, and giving a priority to freight trains. The amount of times that I've been on this happens all the time, that you have to stop and let freight trains pass you. It's absurd that we do this in this country, that they have priority. This via schedules are never kept along that corridor because we have to move the goods on a tighter timeline because they own the tracks, the CN rail. It's absolutely absurd, and it's embarrassment.
David, your thoughts on that?
No, I agree with actually both comments that have been made. It is important to have the regional transportation. It is certainly true that if you go to most countries in Europe and indeed in Asia, you'll find that the regional transportation systems are far, far better, and they've been at it much longer. I think the railway planners have failed us in making sure we were there. Are they important to have? Yes, they are. Karen's right. I think in terms of priority, we need to worry about some other things in transportation. But boy, we should get back on the regional transit understanding of its importance for our future.
Let's go to the phones now, 416-360-0740, toll-free 1-866-744-740. We're talking about what was in the Toronto, the federal budget for Toronto and other cities. Frank in Ancaster, you're on the line. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm really upset about this because, you know, I'm retired and retired for quite some time, and I'm okay, and there's a lot of people that aren't okay to start with. And then they're sitting there contriving this budget the night before we're going to get a massive increase in the gas price. Okay? So now people are going to just bite their lip hard to realize that they're going to have to do it. Right now, for a 60-liter tank, it's going to cost you $700.
No.
Are you still there?
No.
I'm sorry. I got that.
Yeah, it would be around $100.
Yeah, $107. I beg your pardon.
Okay.
I got like seven fixed up here. But the point is, now, what's going to happen with this thing is we all know the prices are going to go up from oil. From oil alone, everything is going to go up because that's where it all starts. I've always been convinced that inflation is started by oil, not by the banks. The banks, and I'm not going to give the banks credit for much, but here's what's going to happen. We're going to have people in the workforce demanding more money, okay? And they're, and by demanding more money, all the prices are going to go up for everything we buy. And the Bank of Canada, they're going to be really scratching their head as to whether or not we're in a, we're in an environment where they can lower the interest rates, because they won't be able to, because the prices will be skyrocketing again, and people will be running out buying things on their credit card, and that'll stimulate more inflation.
Okay, so not specific to home building, your call, but more the big picture. Let's go now to Sita in Mississauga, our friend Sita. Hello there.
Hi, Jane. Thank you so much. Hi, everyone. So everyone was screaming for more housing and blaming the federal government for not doing anything, And now the government is giving billions of dollars. Why are mayors not jumping at this money and build 2 to 3 story buildings with underground parking? Do more rentals, which is more affordable for people, and more shelters.
Oh, that is a good question. Karen, do you have thoughts on Sita's comments?
Yeah, no, so, you know, again, it's the governments are balancing a lot of interests as well. And it's again, a function of, you know, what projects are already being planned and what can be executed more quickly versus how do we protect affordable units? Because those are two different issues. And then, you know, building the three stories across, you know, all the avenues is been something the city has been advocating for as long as I've been on council. It's just, you know, the government is not in a position right now to be building that housing. So we're reliant on the private sector to do it. And to date, it hasn't been economical for that to happen. And so trying to figure out how to encourage the private sector to build the homes that we need is one thing. And then, you know, supporting that through loans and low interest loans is another. But then if the government is actually in the business of building houses, which I don't suggest they do, then that's another thing entirely. And so, again, each level of government controls different levers, and the city's at the bottom of the ring just trying to figure out how to advance things. But the role the city plays is significant because they're the ones that can actually have projects go quicker or slower, depending on the amount of policies or reviews or, you know, considerations that go into how a building gets constructed. And so, you know, it takes years right now. It absolutely takes years for a project to get approved before the building even begins.
Okay, that is a good place to leave the conversation about the federal budget. We have a few minutes left. I want to hear from the three of you about how you think Mayor Chao, Budget Chief Shelley Carroll, the rest of Toronto City Council has dealt with this debacle of a Toronto vacant home tax rollout. And I believe we're at David. David, they're trying to take care of business. They've tried to reassure those who got those errant bills not to pay, not to worry.
Well, it was a big mistake, big apology, and they need to fix it. I don't think there's much more that I can say about that.
And how do you think they've handled it in terms of reassuring Toronto homeowners?
Well, I think people will wait and see what they're actually going to do. The announcement by the mayor was that they were going to fix it, and that's all what you can say at this point. But they need to really do it, and there needs to be some understanding that you just can't afford to have mistakes made like this that are so... that affect people so strongly.
Yeah, huge mistake. We know from Mayor Chao that the person responsible for designing this system is no longer with the city. Surprised it's only one person, Alex?
Yeah, I mean, this was clearly just such a debacle. It's really unfortunate. I think the tax is well-intentioned. But I mean, even I moved about, I don't know, 7 months ago, and my old landlord had to track me down because she got hit with this bill, and she needed me to write a letter saying that I lived there.
Right.
And even she lived in the house, too. It was a multi-story, multi-unit house. And she had to go and appeal it and send that there were people living in it and all of that. So clearly a lot of extra work for people and a bit of a disaster.
So you were caught up in this, too.
Yeah, exactly.
Karen, how do you think it's being managed in the aftermath?
Well, yeah. I mean, again, I don't think anybody realized it was an annual thing that had to be done. It came to my attention quite luckily, and so I was not caught up in it. But even as I was doing it, I thought this is not going to work out, because if everybody needs to do this every year, there's got to be a better way. So it does, when, you know, I know David talked about fixing it, but I think there is a fundamental question of its utility, because we're already seeing how people are going, skirting it, getting, you know, having temporary people move in, you know, putting their houses on the market at unreasonable prices because they actually don't want to sell it. They just want it to be vacant, but then they can declare that it's not vacant. So it just, I know the whole idea was that if we have this vacant home tax, it'll encourage people to rent their houses or rent their apartments or rent their condos to others in need of a house or a home, but I don't think it's playing out that way. And so I think before we fix anything, we have to go back to this drawing board and really have a discussion about whether or not it makes sense.
Okay. Thank you all very much for your comments, as usual. And I will chat with you again next week. Libby's on vacation next week. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
That is our Tune Into the Town panel. Alex Blumenstein, co-founder of The Peak. Karen Stintz, CEO at Variety Village. David Crombie, former mayor of Toronto. Jane for Libby. And coming up next on Fight Back, a unanimous vote motion to reverse a ban on the keffiyeh in the legislature fails to pass. We get reaction from one of the provincial party leaders, as well as B'nai B'rith Canada next.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio with guest host Jane Brown.
Libby will be back tomorrow to take your calls on Free for All Friday. A call by all of Ontario's party leaders, including PC Premier Doug Ford, to reverse a ban on wearing a keffiyeh in the Ontario legislature has failed to pass in a unanimous vote this morning. The Speaker, Ted Arnott, who originally imposed the ban, acknowledged the request to have the ban reversed. And when it was put to a unanimous vote, a motion by NDP leader Marit Stiles, he said he could hear some no's. So for now, the ban stands. Keffiyehs are black and white checked scarves, culturally worn by Arabs, but have been used to serve as a symbol of the Palestinian resistance movement. A keffiyeh was worn by Yasser Arafat, leader of the Palestine Liberation Organization. Speaker Ted Arnott decided to impose the ban, saying he sees it as being intended to be a political statement during these highly charged times of the Israel-Hamas war, which began after the terror attacks of October 7th. But Premier Ford and the other party leaders put out statements saying they would like the decision reversed, the Premier saying it needlessly divides the people of our province. Last hour, I recorded a conversation with Green Party leader Mike Schreiner about the vote to reverse the ban, which did not pass with unanimous approval. I asked him first, what happened this morning?
Yeah, so the motion was a unanimous consent motion. So that then leads to a voice kind of vote of yay or nay. And if everyone says yes, it passes. And even if one person says no, it doesn't. And there was an individual who did say no. And so the motion doesn't pass because it's not unanimous consent. It doesn't mean that a similar motion could be brought forward at some time in the future. I was surprised and disappointed because all four party leaders have said that they would like to see the Speaker reverse the ban of wearing keffiyehs in the legislature. But as the Speaker noted, it will take, he will abide by a unanimous consent motion. And unfortunately, that did not happen this morning.
Can you say, because it is public, it was hard to tell listening and watching, who was the individual, which MPP said no?
You know what, Jane, it was hard for me to tell. I do know it came from someone in the Conservative caucus. I mean, it was obviously on that side of the House. But I definitively can't definitively say who it was. I think we were all surprised, especially after the Premier's comments last night.
Mm-hmm. So the ban stands. It kind of came out of the blue, the whole thing. Why do you think the Speaker, Ted Arnott, enacted the ban of the keffiyeh in the first place?
Well, I think I don't want to speculate or speak on behalf of the Speaker, so that I'm not sure about. When I learned of this on Tuesday, I wrote a letter on Wednesday morning, first thing, asking the Speaker to reconsider, because for many people, the keffiyeh is, you know, part of their cultural attire. And so while some people may see it as a political statement, for many people, it's part of their cultural clothing. And we certainly don't ban other forms of cultural clothing at Queen's Park. And I certainly would not want us to do that. And so I felt that the Speaker should reconsider the ban. And the Speaker made it clear this morning that if there was unanimous consent, he obviously would fulfill the wishes of the House and reverse the ban. But unfortunately, one person said no to the UC motion.
Right. But it seems like this is making an issue out of something that was not an issue. There was no discussion of this prior to the Speaker enacting this ban against the keffiyeh. So it almost seems like it is a fabricated concern.
Yeah, you know what? You'd have to talk to the Speaker about that, Jane. I mean, my assumption is, and again, this would be pure speculation, and I hesitate to be, engage in speculation. My guess, somebody brought this to the attention of the Speaker, complained to the Speaker about it, and the Speaker responded.
Okay.
Once I learned about it, I wrote a letter asking the Speaker to reverse the ban on the keffiyeh, because I believe it's a cultural piece of clothing that should be allowed in the legislature, just like we allow other pieces of cultural clothing. But obviously now it's blown up into an issue that I was hoping we would have resolved today through this unanimous consent motion, but unfortunately that did not happen.
So from your vantage point in the legislature, and we're speaking with Green Party leader Mike Schreiner, the Ontario Green Party leader, do you see people, MPPs and guests in the gallery wearing the keffiyeh? Have you seen the keffiyeh being worn by people in the legislature lately?
I have seen the keffiyeh worn prior to October 7th in the legislature and after October 7th in the legislature, both by one particular member who's, you know, this is their culture, as well as occasionally by visitors, you know, to Queen's Park, who I've seen wearing the keffiyeh again prior to October 7th and after October 7th in what, you know, the precinct. So that's just the Queen's Park building or the lawn. So I have seen it worn, yes.
And as you say, there are no other pieces of clothing that are banned from being worn in the legislature, symbols, necklaces with symbols, that kind of thing. There is, as far as you know, nothing else is banned.
Yeah, now there is a prohibition on wearing things that advocate for certain political positions. So, you know, if I wore a button into the legislature that said, you know, ban all fossil fuels, for example, that would not be allowed. And I know as a member that that's not allowed unless I ask for unanimous consent for like something like that to be worn or for a prop to be used. And so I think in this case, you know, the concern is the keffiyeh a political symbol in post October 7th, possibly a political symbol saying, you know, pro-Palestine, or is it a piece of cultural clothing? Historically, it has been a piece of cultural clothing. I think it probably has heightened political meaning, obviously, given the situation in Israel-Palestine right now. But, you know, there are members in the House that wear pieces of clothing or maybe jewelry that reflects their culture or their religion that is allowed to be worn in the House.
And oftentimes we will see members wearing ribbons of color or clothing of color, which adheres to maybe a certain day in the calendar for advocating for certain individuals or organizations. That is allowed, yes?
It is allowed with a unanimous consent motion. So what will happen is, so, you know, maybe it's pink shirt day and people want to wear a pink ribbon. There will be a unanimous consent motion at allowing members to wear that ribbon that particular day in the House. And generally, you know, everyone always says yes to those unanimous consent motions because they're not controversial and all members want to show their support for, you know, the particular cause on that day. I mean, one of the most recent ones was wearing the daisy as part of Cancer Prevention Month in the House. But before we were all able to do that, a unanimous consent motion was approved, allowing us to do that. And that's what we were hoping would happen this morning. But unfortunately, it did not happen.
So, Mike, how much time needs to lapse before another member can introduce a similar motion to reverse the ban?
Another motion could be introduced, you know, at the end of question period today. Somebody could get up on a point of order and ask for unanimous consent again. I'm not sure if that's going to happen or not yet, but it's certainly possible.
Okay, this has been very interesting. Thank you so much for your time, Mike.
Hey, Jane, anytime.
That is Green Party leader Mike Schreiner. I was in conversation with him last hour. You are welcome to call in on this hot button topic, the banning of the keffiyeh in the Ontario legislature, 416-360-0740, 1-866-744-740. Now we go to Richard Robertson of B'nai B'rith Canada, the country's oldest independent Jewish human rights organization. Richard, welcome.
Thank you for having me, Jane.
So how do you see this issue of banning wearing the keffiyeh in the legislature?
We believe that the speaker's decision is in line with the policy of the legislature. The keffiyeh was once an innocuous cultural symbol. However, the keffiyeh's meaning has been politicized since October 7th. The politicization has only increased, obviously to the point where the speaker felt that the wearing of the keffiyeh in Queen's Park was no longer an issue. Therefore, the speaker took action, which is in line with the policies of the legislature that prohibit political clothing or items of demonstration in the gallery and that prevent members of provincial parliament from wearing props.
Okay, so how did this come to be? Did B'nai B'rith Canada as an organization call for the banning of the keffiyeh? Were you involved in advocating for that in any way?
No, we were not. However, we are supportive of the measure. We have been concerned by the misappropriation of the meaning of the keffiyeh by members of provincial parliament, by visitors to Queen's Park, and as well by members of the federal parliament.
So what political symbolism do you feel it now represents, the keffiyeh, since the terror attacks on Israel October 7th?
Well, as you indicated earlier in the segment, Jane, the keffiyeh has been affiliated with Palestinian resistance movements, some of which are terror groups. Since the 1960s, it was popularized by Yasser Arafat and has been worn as a symbol by members of other terror factions. So we do believe that it is an inciting and a divisive political prop. It no longer has the same cultural meaning that it used to when being worn in the legislature.
Okay, but would there be individuals wearing the keffiyeh, in your opinion, who are adhering to a cultural piece of clothing, the original meaning or the original function for the keffiyeh?
There's nothing wrong with wearing a keffiyeh. The right to wear a keffiyeh is not in question. We support the right of all individuals seeking to proudly identify with their cultural heritage. What has happened is the speaker has decided that at this time, a time of increased incitement and division within Ontario society, that the keffiyeh can be seen as a political symbol, and he has chosen to ban it from the legislature.
Let's go to the phones now, 416-360-0740 or toll-free 1-866-744-740. Ron in Guelph, what are your thoughts about this issue?
Thanks for taking my call. Well, this banning of the keffiyeh is going to set a dangerous precedent. I understand what the person, Mr. Richardson, just spoke about. But I'm going to go down to the Quebec legislature in Quebec City, where they banned all symbols of religion, right?
Yes.
They decided they couldn't even have a cross in the legislature in Quebec City. So are we going to be now at the point where the Minister of Transportation has to remove his turban? Are we going to be telling Jewish members or people in the legislature, you cannot wear a yarmulke? I get a yarmulke. I guess I can't pronounce it properly. I understand the symbolism, but I just think it's setting a bad precedent to ban this. That's all.
Okay, Ron, thank you for your call. You bring up an interesting topic, possibly a slippery slope. Richard Robertson?
I respectfully disagree with the caller, Jane. There is no religious requirement to wear a keffiyeh as there would be for a kippah, or for a turban, or for a hijab. As a result, I don't believe that there is a slippery slope as well. This ban does not need to be infinite. It was simply done at the discretion of the speaker during a time, as I said earlier, of heightened division in our society. And I believe it was done in order to ensure that the environment within Queen's Park and the legislature was not unduly corrupted as a result.
Really appreciate your perspective and time. Thank you, Richard.
Thank you for having me.
Richard Robertson is with B'nai B'rith Canada. It is Jane for Libby. And still to come, putting in perspective the trial of Umar Zamir. Defense lawyer Ari Goldkind joins us next.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio with guest host Jane Brown.
Libby will be waiting for your calls tomorrow on Free For All Friday. The trial of a man accused of killing a Toronto police officer back in July 2021 is coming to an end. The late Detective Constable Jeffrey Northrup was struck by a vehicle July 2nd, 2021, while responding to a robbery report in Toronto's City Hall parkade. Umar Zamir was arrested and charged as the suspect. The accused has pleaded not guilty to first-degree murder and told court that he thought the officer and the officer's partner, both in plain clothes, were approaching his car to attack his family. In essence, it seemed as though, according to him, he panicked in the moment. Joining us to talk about what has become a captivating trial in Toronto, criminal defense lawyer Ari Goldkind. Ari, thank you for your time.
Welcome, Libby. Captivating doesn't even begin to describe it. There are so many adjectives. We probably don't have enough time.
Right. It is Jane, by the way, Ari. Libby's off
today. Oh,
sorry,
Jane. Hi, Jane.
Hi. No worries. Just wrap up for us this trial. What has happened on this trial?
So just to bring people into the courtroom, Jane, this has been a prosecution that should never have been brought. We're only talking about this because of the political and police pressure and Crown Attorney pressure to see this case through. Any conviction here would be a miscarriage of justice. The evidence is weaker than any homicide I've ever seen, and that's saying something, because I've seen dozens. The case against Mr. Zamir was, I think, very much mistakenly told to us from the time of his arrest, where he was sort of tarred and feathered as a cop killer. And if you'll remember, a judge of the Superior Court and his defense team came out and said, everybody take a chill pill. I'd like to tell you more, but my hands are tied. By the way, it's one of the reasons we got to stop having these publication bans where the public doesn't understand why somebody gets bail. Remember the outcry
from
politicians when he got bail, and we were all under the impression, why are we letting a cop killer go free? Well, he's not only not a cop killer with a guilty state of mind, you've got to remember, particularly if you're you know, a listener to Zoomer who likes watching Law and Order or, you know, FBI or CSI or the 12 other, you know, shows that we all love.
Sure.
Here you have police officers, Jane, and I'm being serious, by the way. You have three police officers that colluded and put their evidence together, which is forbidden in my business. And their evidence of what happened was contradicted by video footage and the reconstruction experts. You then add in the fact that Mr. Zamir didn't wake up that morning, a 34-year-old accountant with an 8-month pregnant wife, a child strapped into a car seat in the back, and say, you know what, as I leave the underground parking lot, as I drive out of there, I really want to mull over a cop that day. So there are so many problems with this prosecution. And again, look, I'm friendly with the Crowns. I understand the pressure brought to bear on them, but a conviction here, Jane, would take what is unquestionably a horrific tragedy, and it would turn it into a massive injustice. So I'm watching this. I don't think this should have ever gone to a jury. I don't think the backup verdict of manslaughter, which is, you know, where a jury hedges and says we got to punish him for something. There is no case here, and it should not even be in a courtroom.
It's almost the opposite, isn't it? The prosecution is playing more the defense, and the defense is playing more the prosecution.
So I love that you say that, Jane. I love that you say that, and here's why. Because we can do these by-the-book, you know, interviews where it's like, oh, you got to meet the burden of proof, and the Crown has the burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt, and the defense has to prove nothing. Okay, cliche, even though that's true aside, this is, as I've said from the beginning of this, Jane, people can go find that I've said this. This is literally the dream case of a defense lawyer. Why? So many times you have a homicide, you have nothing to work with. You have a guilty client. You have an unseemly client. You have an unlikable client. You have a client with a criminal record as long as your left leg. Here, you have not only a lovely, hardworking 34-year-old accountant going downtown on Canada Day to show his kid around the toilet that Toronto has turned into. Late at night, they realize, oh, this is turning into a toilet. We better get back to our car. We just saw a stabbing happen. Here you have a man who is proving that he's innocent. And from the time the police bash into his car, again, very sadly and tragically, as Officer Northrop lost his life.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't even know he's dealt with police. He doesn't even know that he's run somebody over. There is, in my business, and you know, I think a lot of your listeners will know the term, guilty mind. To be convicted of a criminal offense, you really have to have a guilty mind. We don't convict in tragedies or accidents. And here, to your question, Jane, which is why it's such a good one, this is a case that could have been won if the defense didn't call one witness, if they just shut up and said, the Crown's case is terrible. Their own witnesses contradict each other. To Mr. Zamir, and I give this right to him, Jane, I give this right to him. To Mr. Zamir's credit, he not only calls his own expert, which agrees with the Crown expert that the Crown case is foolish, his wife testifies very believably about the terror they felt when they saw these people running up to their car. The Crown's theory, Jane, was, well, he should have cracked the window and asked, are you really police officers? Now, that's not how it works when you think you're being terrorized.
Mm-hmm.
And the most important part, and I think a lot of credit here because we're low on time, Mr. Zamir has real remorse. From the witness box, under cross-examination, where he throws himself to the wolves, because, Jane, cross-examination can undress an innocent person. You can get caught in the moment and stressed and nervous, and if the jury thinks you screwed up, that could hurt you. Mr. Zamir put himself in those crosshairs. He turned to the family of Officer Northrop, and he said, I'm so sorry for what I've done. I'm so sorry that you won't have your father and your husband. And I think that will be extremely powerful to the jury. And why do I say that, Jane? Because your question was bang on that Mr. Zamir said, I'm not going to sit on my hands and just do the usual, they didn't prove it. I'm going to show that I'm an innocent man, and I am so sorry that this happened that day.
So help us understand now what the judge said yesterday and is saying today in terms of giving instruction to the jury.
This is one of the finest, brassiest judges in Canada. She's a dream for both Crown and defense to have. I think if this was up to her and not a jury, I don't even think she'd give it 2 seconds of thought. That's how clear a verdict this is. She must instruct them on first-degree murder, Jane. That's basically not the planning and deliberation that we always think with first, but killing an officer that you know is an officer. That's what elevates it to first. If the jury accepts that he intended to kill a person or was reckless as to whether he was going to kill a person, that's where second-degree murder comes in. If they accept that he didn't know that that's a police officer. Then there's the terrible manslaughter fallback. Remember, I just said that a few minutes ago. That's basically that when he reversed, once they tried to box him in and he reversed, his driving was so dangerous that that's the unlawful act that gets him to manslaughter because it caused the death. That seems very meek, milquetoast, and feckless to me. Look, juries sometimes want to split the difference, so that may be of some appeal to them. Or, and lastly, she will instruct them very carefully on the fact that he might be completely not guilty. We use the term innocent, but it's really not guilty. She'll go through a decision tree with the jury that say, if you believe X, then go to Y. If you don't believe X, then it's over. So it's that kind of very analytical thought process. But one of the things I'll say, Jane, as we wrap up, is a lot of times jury charges can be extraordinarily and overly confusing. At its core, this is a very simple case, and if the jury doesn't come back, as I predict, with the verdict that I predict, I think we will have one of the greatest injustices in Canadian history.
So just very quickly, in 20 seconds, when the jury comes back, will they be asked if the defendant, will they begin to go down a list? Guilty of first, what will happen?
I don't need 20 seconds. I can tell you they'll come in with a verdict. It'll be one or two words tops. Then that will be it.
And your prediction is he will be acquitted of any kind of murder-related charges?
Absolutely.
I knew you would put it all in perspective for us. Thank you, Ari.
Good to be with you, Jane.
Criminal defense lawyer Ari Goldkind. Jane for Libby. And remember, tomorrow is Free for All Friday. Libby will be here. Looking forward to taking your calls on the issues of the week. The number ones at one are coming up next after Bob Comsic News.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.